a fraction is really distributed.
So that's Jan Egeland. He's the Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. Now, this is the main group in Gaza in charge of shelters and tents. He was in Gaza this month, and he says that the destruction from airstrikes has left the entire territory in ruins. Now, Israel's military says it is facilitating a humanitarian response to prepare for winter in Gaza, that it has allowed tons of aid in. But Egeland says at the rate Israel is allowing in tents and other aid, it will take at least 2 years to get the supplies in needed just to cover people for this winter. Wow. And Rob, Egeland says of the few hundred tents they have been able to get into Gaza, many are damaged by the time they arrive, or they end up stolen by armed gangs that have sprung up near Gaza's border with Israel. And these looters attacked a food aid convoy of around 100 UN trucks last week, taking everything.
This just sounds like a completely dismal situation. What else do you know about the attack on the aid truck that you just mentioned?
So this was the biggest looting of UN aid anywhere in the world, and armed gangs are taking advantage of the chaos right now in Gaza to attack these trucks. And what that's done is it's driven up prices at the same time that bakeries are shutting down because they don't have flour. People are selling their clothes, their winter jackets and shoes to buy food. And the World Food Program, which runs these bakeries, also had to suspend giving out parcels. And all this is happening while tents, flour, and blankets are sitting in warehouses and on trucks just outside Gaza.
That's NPR's Aya Betraoui. Aya, thank you so much for bringing this to us.
Thanks, Rob.
The journalist Eric Garcia came by our studio to talk the other day, and he found it comfortable.
You know, I'm glad that there's no fluorescent lights because that would be a sensory processing nightmare for someone like me.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And like on top of that, like even I have to time out when I take the metro to go to work because if it is too crowded, that will just...
You're overwhelmed.
Yes.
Garcia is autistic. His disability is in the news, including news stories that Garcia himself has been writing. So we asked him over to talk about it. Would you define autism as you understand it?
Basically, it is a disability of, in many ways, of communication and of social interaction, and that includes people who are willing to, who are able to speak and who can't speak. That includes people who require around the clock care and people who can live independently.
Garcia lives independently, although he spent a lot of time in school learning how to navigate life.
I mean, I was bullied a lot. I think a lot of times I didn't understand why people were taking advantage of me. I didn't understand a lot of the social cues. A lot of it just felt like a form. A lot of what my peers were doing, particularly men.
Meaning you didn't understand how to relate to the boys.
I didn't understand how to relate to people.
People like the kid who offered Garcia a diagnosis.
Kids have diagnostic labels too. And I remember one time I was in special ed. I was in fourth grade. And this one kid says, you know what RSP stands for, right? And I was like, what? He says, really stupid people.
And here's what finally made things better.
It wasn't really until I was in college that I accepted, yeah, I'm disabled, because then I needed to get accommodation services to get more time on tests, to be with my guidance counselors, things like that. So I went to community college before I went to university.
This sounds like what you needed was the academic equivalent of timing your ride on the subway.
Yes, exactly.
If you make adjustments, you're fine.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Clearly, you've adapted. You're a Washington correspondent and bureau chief for The Independent, a British paper.
Correct, I am.
And now covering, among other things, the nomination of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to a cabinet position at the Department of Health and Human Services. What's that been like?
Oh, boy.
Kennedy has promoted theories that vaccines cause autism and has questioned large scientific studies that show no link at all. In the halls of the Capitol, Eric Garcia interviewed some Republican senators who took an interest in Kennedy's theories. What truly bothers you about the idea of people walking around thinking that vaccines caused your condition or anybody's condition like yours?
Yeah, what really bothers me, a few things. One is there's this idea that autism is so terrible and finding something to blame on it rather than loving and accepting autistic people.
Garcia believes this is just how he is, autistic, a characteristic like his height or his eye color.
Your humanity is not defined by whether or not you're fixed, quote unquote.
He does not see autism as a disease, like cancer, yet people have spent generations suggesting that somebody must have done something wrong, like the researchers in the mid-1900s who blamed parenting styles.
Autism was caused by these unloving refrigerator parents.
That was the notion, which eventually was discredited and then replaced, for some, by vaccine theories.
I really have a lot of sympathy for parents because for so long they were blamed for their children being autistic, and then they have something to pin the blame on with vaccines.
During the presidential campaign, Kennedy talked about vaccines, and the day after the election, he told NPR that he would have the power to follow his beliefs. How quickly will you act on federal support for vaccines or research on vaccines?
I will work immediately on that.
Kennedy vows to pursue what he considers deficiencies in the studies to better inform citizens, which Eric Garcia considers a distraction from a much more promising approach.
We spend such a drop in the bucket on lifespan issues when it comes to research at the NIH and the National Institutes of Health. We spend so little on the services that people need in transition from childhood to adulthood. We could have focused on that, and instead we focused on what's causing this terrible thing and how can we stop it. And that really is a waste of time, and it's also saying that autistic people are something that need to be prevented. That's what really offends me, aside from the public health thing, which is terrible.
When I've talked to some more conservative people, they will sometimes raise questions about RFK's beliefs on this or that issue, but they seem to feel he's not going to be able to do what they would consider to be crazy stuff.
Well, I mean, the thing of it is that he's still the secretary. There's still a lot of, you know, think about all the things that HHS encompasses, that encompasses the National Institutes of Health, that encompasses Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. If he's confirmed, he will have a lot of discretion and authority.
Kennedy's stance on vaccines could affect the lives of millions and people like Eric Garcia just a little more than most. He will be covering that story as a reporter while also living it.
For many years, if you were a power player in the nation's capital, steakhouses were where you went to talk shop and cut deals, often over a martini. Charlie Palmer's Steak was one of the best. But today, the pricey steakhouse closes its doors. In 2007, NPR reporter Ben Bergman brought us inside the Capitol Hill destination.
In the dining room of Charlie Palmer's Steak, a rock pool decorated with flowers chills the massive wine cellar perched above. You can take your pick of thousands of wines, including ones from every state. Once you've ordered drinks, time to consider the main course.
Right now we have a hickory smoked salmon over a ragu of leeks and fingerling potatoes with cured tomatoes.
That sounds wonderful. That was former executive chef Brian Voltaggio. When the restaurant's D.C. location opened in 2003, it made a splash, explains Jessica Sidman, food editor for Washingtonian magazine.
Charlie Palmer's Steak is really a fixture of Capitol Hill.
Sidman says location of Charlie Palmer's Steak in the shadow of the Capitol made it a go-to for lobbyists and legislators.
It's going to end up being a cafeteria of Congress in a lot of ways, right? At least if you're willing to spend a certain amount of money.
Sidman says Charlie Palmer is, in many ways, a backroom to history.
People who work in places like that, they hear the news before it's on the news, right?
And perhaps so did Palmer himself.
So my name is Charlie Palmer. I'm a chef and restaurateur and hotelier at this point.
Palmer says when the restaurant first opened in D.C., the goal was to present a new kind of steakhouse.
Charlie's mantra is always genuine American hospitality.
That's Daniel Perrin, another former executive chef at Charlie Palmer. He says what set the restaurant apart was how it treated diners. Palmer says that's the most important ingredient for any restaurant.
What is a restaurant to most diners, and especially regular diners? Yes, the food has to be good and the service has to be good. Really what they're wanting or what they are looking for is someone to take care of them.
He says the D.C. restaurant couldn't make a deal with its landlord to stay open, but Palmer says he has not ruled out opening another one in the nation's capital. This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 8:19 on this Friday. Still lots more to get to in the show, including Wisconsin Life. We've got it each and every Wednesday and Friday on the show. Today we're going to hear from an Oneida resident about a journey of self-discovery and finding out who you truly are. That story is coming up in about 25 minutes. Plus, we'll still hear a story about India, the world's most populous democracy, and how the support for President-elect Donald Trump there is pretty strong. That's ahead.
Whether your weekend is full of work or play, recharging or catching up, life doesn't stop. And the news and the stories that impact your life every day, they don't slow down. All Things Considered is here every Saturday and Sunday to bring you the news and help you lighten up with the latest in music, movies, and books. Join us for thoughtful conversations and reporting that keeps you in the know and your weekend rolling.
Saturday afternoon at 4 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from HGA, a national multidisciplinary design firm dedicated to sustainable building practices. Offices in Madison, Milwaukee, and across the country. More at hga.com.
Support for WGTD comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. ADRC provides free memory screen Mondays for those concerned about memory changes. Call to schedule an appointment. The number is 262-605-6646.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. A winter weather advisory is in effect for Vilas County until noon today and for Iron and Bayfield counties until 6 tomorrow morning. That's because we could see some lake effect snow in those areas. Elsewhere, things are going to be pretty cold across the state today with high temperatures peaking in the teens and 20s. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the John Templeton Foundation, funding interdisciplinary research and catalyzing conversations to inspire awe and wonder. Information about the wonders of the universe is at templeton.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals with a track record of excellence. More information on this year's MacArthur Fellows is at macfound.org. From the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz. While many Americans are away from their computers celebrating Thanksgiving, cybercriminals are lying in wait to prey on holiday anxieties. Consumers and companies alike are potential targets, NPR's Jenna McLaughlin reports.
Hackers love the holidays. Tryptophan-induced turkey hazes, Black Friday shopping crazes. It's the perfect time to take advantage of people's fears and anxieties, their complacency, to test a company's defenses. But Paul Fabara, Visa's chief risk officer, says he is locked in on what the bad guys are up to.
It's my personal quest. I wake up every day thinking about what else can I do to stop these folks from being successful.
That means needing to stay aware of the threats. First of all, Fabara says that cyber criminals are getting really good at gobbling up stolen information and using artificial intelligence to better understand the trends, what we're buying, how we're behaving, and where we might be vulnerable to fraud. More specifically, they know that Americans are worried about rising prices thanks to high tariffs on goods, a promise made by the incoming Trump administration.
Websites lead with the whole notion of tariffs going up and then inflation's going to go up, so take advantage of this, and the prices are incredibly good.
In fact, probably too good to be true. Fabara says scammers are currently taking aim at electronics, TVs, soundbars, technology whose components are made around the world. The sense of urgency, anxiety, and stress, it forces people into making mistakes they might otherwise avoid.
And of course, it's getting closer to the holidays, and they feel that pressure. And that a lot of times clouds their judgment when it comes to making the right decision.
Plus, attackers are going after companies themselves. A new survey from IT company Viking Cloud says that 52% of retailers feel more at risk of cyber attacks during the holiday season. Hackers are deploying bots to buy up inventory or flood websites with denial-of-service attacks. And companies are worried about ransomware. In fact, software provider Blue Yonder has said it was the victim of a recent ransomware attack. The outage has forced employees at Starbucks, one of Blue Yonder's customers, to work manually across the country, which might make it harder to get a latte to power through that holiday shopping spree. It's a stressful time. Shoppers need to be wary. Double-check that the website hawking a tempting deal is real. Companies need to be vigilant, especially while IT employees might be out of the office celebrating with their families too. But artificial intelligence isn't just helping the criminals. Fabara says Visa's fraud detection system is scanning for threats 24 hours a day. Sometimes he calls the office in the dead of night, just to make sure.
Sunday at, 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning.
After all, hackers never take a holiday. Jenna McLaughlin, NPR News.
It was the introduction that changed music history.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
A little over 60 years ago, the Beatles appeared on The Ed Sullivan Show, and popular music in this country was never the same. To commemorate that night, Disney Plus just started streaming Beatles 64, a documentary about the band's first visit to America in 1964. NPR's Felix Contreras is a Beatles fan and has watched this documentary. Welcome, Felix.
Hey, man. How you doing?
Good. So this is the Beatles. So much is already known about them. I feel like I just saw a very long documentary about them on Disney Plus, produced by Peter Jackson, about their last album. What made this documentary different?
Rob, these guys were kids, man. Ringo and John were 23. Paul was 21. George was 20. And the film captures them in the eye of this popular culture hurricane. And what we see is they are virtually prisoners in their hotel room, in the Plaza Hotel in New York, because the teeny boppers that they hear outside, they would tear them to shreds if they left the room. So there's this rarely seen footage of amused boredom. They're reading papers, listening to the radio, trying to act natural with these cameras in their faces.
So Felix, it's worth pointing out that all of this was happening as the United States was going through some major changes. We have to look at the historical perspective here. In 1964, the civil rights movement was front and center in the nation's consciousness, and these four Brits just get dropped in the middle of that. Did that have any impact on the Beatles at that time?
You know, this film deals with the Beatles and race in a way that I've never seen before. In fact, there's a fascinating interview with Smokey Robinson of Motel fame. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
They were the first white group that I'd ever heard in my life say, yeah, we grew up listening to black music. We love Motown. No other white artist had ever said that. Not anyone of magnitude. Until the Beatles said that.
Huh.
Yeah, the film presents the growing popularity of the Beatles in black and Latino audiences. Again, something I've never seen before. There's also this really cool story by vocalist Ronnie Spector. Now, when her group, the Ronettes, toured England, the Beatles went to see them. So when they were arrived in New York, they called up Ronnie Spector, said, hey, bring the band by. Let's hang out at the hotel. She snuck them out of the back door of the hotel, took them to Harlem, and they ended up having lunch or dinner at this barbecue joint, and no one recognized them.
Oh, my gosh.
It was a momentary relief from the craziness of Beatlemania. It was pretty cool.
So I think what a lot of people remember about those Ed Sullivan performances was the audience. I mean, the women in the crowd just completely losing it. You know, I wonder if this documentary focuses more on the actual performance, like how the band sounded back then.
You know what, Rob? It's still astounding to me to see how polished they were at that age. This film covers a two-week visit to the U.S. In February 9, they played Ed Sullivan in New York. February 16, they played the Ed Sullivan Show in Miami Beach. And in between, they did a gig on February 11th at the Washington Coliseum, which was normally used for boxing matches, circuses, family entertainment. This was their first ever public performance in front of a live audience here in the U.S.
Wow.
Not in front of a TV audience, in front of all those screaming girls that you mentioned. You know, ultimately, Beatles 64 offers another glimpse of four young guys having the time of their lives making extremely well-crafted music in the moments just before they became this worldwide phenomenon and the people that we know today.
That's Felix Contreras. He's the co-host of the Alt Latino podcast for NPR Music. And fun fact, he also has his own Latin Beatles cover band. Thank you, Felix.
Thank you, Rob.
This is NPR News.
Exercise is key to maintaining a healthy body and mind, especially later in life. But a new CDC study shows that over 85% of adults 65 and up don't get enough of it.
Rest is rust, motion is lotion. Get up and move. You have to do something.
I'm Ari Shapiro. How some older adults are staying active and having fun while doing it on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story plus the day's news from 3 until 6:30 on WPR.
This is WPR News.
Good morning. Thanks for being here on this Friday, the 29th of November, for Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:29 with news from NPR and WPR starting now.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. This is one of the busiest shopping days of the year in the U.S. in stores and online. Black Friday is the traditional start to the holiday shopping season. The National Retail Federation expects a record of more than 183 million shoppers to spend money through Cyber Monday. The FBI says it's investigating bomb threats made against at least five Democratic members of Congress from Connecticut. Each said the threat was received on Thanksgiving Day. This follows bomb threats made to some of President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet selections. This week's start of a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon is sparking optimism that a similar deal can be reached between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. NPR's Scott Newman is in Tel Aviv.
Egypt's President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi and Qatar's Prime Minister Abdel Rahman al-Thani met on Wednesday in Cairo to discuss a joint approach to getting a truce in Gaza. Meanwhile, Egyptian media report this week that intelligence officials from Cairo traveled to Israel for meetings on a ceasefire, but Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office has denied this. The Biden administration has said it plans to renew a push on Turkey, Egypt, Qatar, and Israel to get a ceasefire in Gaza and a release of the remaining hostages. Scott Newman, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. A new report this fall ranked Wisconsin among the worst states for broadband internet. The private firm Broadband Now ranked states based on broadband access, performance, and affordability. It relied on data from the Federal Communications Commission, internet service providers, and consumer speed tests. Wisconsin ranked 45th in the nation. Tyler Cooper with Broadband Now says their data team found roughly 78% of residents had broadband access.
I think what we're going to see for people in Wisconsin and people all over the country over the next few years is really a narrowing down of these sort of broadband deserts.
Cooper says Wisconsin is among 18 states that received more than $1 billion in federal funding to expand high-speed internet. That could provide service to around 207,000 eligible locations statewide. A 29-year-old man is facing a federal charge after allegedly charging at a flight attendant and attempting to open an American Airlines plane door midair earlier this month. The flight was headed from Milwaukee to Dallas-Fort Worth last week when the man allegedly said he needed to get off the plane and tried opening the door. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports that other passengers helped subdue the man, who was taken for a mental evaluation once the flight landed in Texas. One flight attendant was injured in the incident. The man now faces a federal charge of interfering with a flight crew by assault or intimidation. American Airlines released a statement thanking employees and customers, quote, for managing a difficult situation. Climate advocates say Wisconsin homeowners can still take advantage of incentives under the Inflation Reduction Act. That comes as President-elect Donald Trump has threatened to rescind unspent funds. Last year, federal data show more than 73,000 families in Wisconsin claimed tax credits to lower energy costs and make home energy upgrades. Kathy Kuntz is the director of the Dane County Office of Energy and Climate Change. She says residents can still claim 30% of the cost for heat pumps, insulation, and installing solar panels. People can also receive anywhere from $1,500 to $10,000 in home rebates administered by the state's Focus on Energy program. More news available at WPR.org. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz in Berlin, Germany. In Ireland, voters are heading to the polls today to elect a new parliament, which will eventually form a new government. The race has tightened in recent days, and Sinn Féin, a party with past links to Irish Republican Army militants, may have a path to power. NPR's Fatima Al-Kassab is in Dublin. Hey, Fatima.
Hi, Rob.
So, Fatima, what are the main issues for voters in Ireland?
Really, it's been housing and the cost of living. Ireland is a very rich country. It's generated a huge income from corporation taxes. It's actually one of the wealthiest in Europe, but people don't really feel it. It's got one of the worst housing crises in the EU, and everyone I've talked to here, whatever their age or economic background, says that housing and the cost of living is key for them. Here's Una Mullally. She's a columnist at the Irish Times, and I spoke to her in Dublin.
Ireland's economy is doing well on paper. There's apparently billions to spend. People aren't seeing it in their services. They're not seeing it in public housing being built at the scale it needs to be built. They're not seeing it in hospital waiting lists reducing.
Wow, billions to spend, but people are not seeing that in their services. So these are the issues. So who are the players?
So you've got the two traditional parties, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, and they're two centre-right parties, and they've governed Ireland either alone or in coalitions for more than a century. They've been in coalition together since 2020, along with the Greens. But in that 2020 election, another party actually won the most votes, but couldn't form a coalition, and that's Sinn Féin.
And that is the left-wing party that used to be the political wing of the IRA.
That's right, the IRA, which is the Irish Republican Army, and they were actually designated a terrorist organization by the US and the UK when they fought for Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, to join the Republic of Ireland, this country, and that was known as the Troubles. Sinn Féin, the party, has made big gains in recent years, and it made historic gains in the last general election in 2020, but it remains to be seen whether they actually have a path to victory this time. But it's issues like housing that have helped Sinn Féin consolidate their place in mainstream Irish politics.
Now, of course, Sinn Féin has a long history in Irish politics. How has the party's role changed over the years?
Yeah, it's had a makeover in recent years. It's got a new leader. She's the first leader not to be connected to the Troubles in Northern Ireland. And she's really been promising to fix the housing crisis. And that's helped them come neck and neck in the polls with the two traditional parties, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. But even if they win the most votes again, they still don't have a clear path to getting into government. They could cobble together a coalition with other smaller left-wing parties, but the most likely scenario is that the two traditional parties will renew their coalition and remain in power after the election today.
So when are we going to know the outcome?
We'll get an exit poll tonight, and that will give us an idea of the vote share. Another thing to look out for, it has been quite wet and windy today, so I'll be watching to see if that affects things and if it affects turnout. And then the counting begins tomorrow. It's a system of proportional representation, so that means it will take some time. And we might not get a proper sense of the results until Saturday afternoon. And then negotiations about who will form the next government probably won't begin until next week.
That's NPR's Fatima Al-Kassab in Dublin. Thanks, Fatima.
Thanks, Rob.
The presidential election in the U.S. earlier this month has divided opinions among the world's democracies. In India, the world's most populous democracy, support for Donald Trump seems strong. NPR's Dia Hadid reports from the southern Indian city of Chennai.
84-year-old Bala Raja exits a Hindu temple after prayers. He sports a New York City cap. It's a gift from his son, who went to the States.
So he came back, that day he brought one cap for me.
It's a nice hat. I had come to this temple in this leafy suburb of Chennai because it's where the mother of Vice President Kamala Harris was raised. I wanted to see if people here had been supporting her bid for the presidency. But there was no sense of loyalty or affection here for Harris among the men I interviewed. In fact, Raja tells me he's all in for Trump.
He's the right man.
The right man.
He's the right man to control the Chinese and Russians.
Raja believes Russian President Vladimir Putin wouldn't have dared invade Ukraine under a Trump administration. Another worshipper nods. He goes by the name R. Srikant. He says now that Trump's coming back,
he will talk to Putin.
Trump will talk to Putin. Stop the war. Views like this echo Trump's messaging during the elections and something he's often repeated, like on Fox News earlier this year.
I was the only president for 78 years. No war started.
In fact, Trump says he ended wars.
I withdrew from Syria. I withdrew from Iraq.
The truth is somewhat more complicated. Nevertheless, that's the message that filtered to Gwadom Nimagada's WhatsApp groups. He's a 29-year-old engineer. We meet him by the Chennai seashore. Nimagada tells me his friends see Trump as a peacemaker.
Trump is more about stopping wars. He wants to bring in peace.
Trump, who openly voiced admiration for Putin, hasn't elaborated on how he'll end wars, particularly Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Trump's detractors worry he'll push Ukraine to accept Russian annexation of some of its territory and claim this outcome as part of a peace deal. Sumitra Badrinathan is an American university political scientist. She says this view of Trump as a peacemaker is widely held.
There's a lot of people across the world who do believe this narrative that Trump is going to end the wars. It's not unique to India.
And in India, men in particular may be more amenable to Trump's claims of being a peacemaker because Indian men are largely amenable to Trump. A June poll by the Pew Research Center found 51% of Indian men had confidence in Trump. Milan Vaishnav directs the South Asia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He thinks that affection for Trump might mirror their views of the Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi.
For some people, and maybe this is more common among men, they see similarities between Modi and Trump.
Analysts say the two leaders are populists, nationalists have come to power, partly by whipping up fears about minorities and promising only they can fix it.
It's this idea that, you know, we live in this chaotic world and we need these sort of larger than life strongmen figures to essentially stabilize the system.
Back at the Hindu temple in Chennai, R. Srikant tells me people are tired of conflict.
Now the world wants some sort of peace so everybody can grow.
But Srikant can't say how Trump will make peace, except that he's somebody who's respected and feared. And maybe that's enough. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Chennai.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. Glad to have you along with us for the show on this Friday. It's 8:42, and we've got plenty more to come this hour, including Wisconsin Life. We've got Wisconsin Life each and every Wednesday and Friday here on the program. Today, we're going to be hearing from an Oneida resident about a journey of self-discovery and finding out who you truly are. That story is coming up in about 3 minutes, plus news coming up at 9 o'clock as well, here on WPR.
This week on Beta, acclaimed film writer Ian Nathan joins us to talk about the Mad Max cinematic universe.
I mean, on Mad Max 3, on Beyond Thunderdome, it got so hot that the metal in the costumes would burn skin.
Saturdays at 11 and Sundays at 10 on WPR News.
Support for WPR comes from the Baraboo Chamber, welcoming all to its downtown square for a holiday experience. With horse-drawn carriage rides and visits with Santa every Saturday during the holiday season. Baraboo.com.
Support for WGTD's local news and public affairs commitment comes from Casey Family Options, a tradition of trust. For more information, including how to get started and pre-planning, visit caseyfamilyoptions.com or call 262-653-0667.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. At 8:44, here's what's happening in news. That truce between Hezbollah and the Israeli military does appear to be holding still at this hour. There is a buffer zone that is set to be put into place that would be patrolled by Lebanese troops and UN peacekeepers. It is Black Friday, and so far this holiday season, online sales have beaten expectations. According to Adobe Insights, U.S. customers spent more than $77 billion online from November 21st to November 24th. That's an increase of more than 9% compared to the same time period last year. and two daycare workers at a child care facility in Fox Point have been fired, and at least one of them has been arrested for alleged child abuse. More news available at WPR.org. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about discovering who you truly are.
While Joseph Ray Torres of Oneida was on his path of self-discovery, something finally clicked for him. He realized he was two-spirit, which for him meant embracing masculine and feminine identities. Torres talked about this with his adopted nephew and mentee, Corey Carline of Green Bay, during a StoryCorps mobile tour stop in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
My name is Corey. I am 33 years old. I am an Indigenous Mexican student, doctoral candidate at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay.
My name is Joseph, age 58. I'm a recent graduate from UWGB. I graduated with a double major in First Nations Studies and Business Administration. I am also Indigenous and Mexican. I identify as a proud two-spirit gay man as well.
When you were growing up, what did your Indigenous identities mean to you?
My mom, she went to a mission school. And so I was raised very Christian. And my dad was Mexican and Pueblo from Dallas, Texas. Because they both dealt with so much racism, even though my mom spoke full-blooded Oneida, she never spoke it to us. And my dad, who was his first language was Spanish, he would not speak it to us. They were both very loving, hardworking parents. But at the same time, I look back and I feel a little bit cheated, not because of anything they did, just because of what they went through. They didn't want us kids to go through that. But I guess I saw other Oneidas and I knew I was Oneida, but I didn't really know what it meant until years later.
What do these identities mean to you now?
Well, they help me keep grounded. They help give me self-confidence. They let me know that I have a place in society, you know, and then coming out as well was very hard. My family took it really well, and my mom, of course, being Christian, was the one that had the hardest time dealing with it. And I was really close to my mom, but because of her Christianity, her response was, believe in the power of prayer. You know, and one of the best gifts I ever received, a friend gave me a book by Walter Williams called Sexual Diversity in Native American Culture, The Flesh and the Spirit. And that really empowered me, gave me an identity that more than anything confirmed that a long time ago before Europeans, Christianity, colonization, two-spirit people were revered. It was believed we were given special gifts and we were given very high roles in our society. There was no such thing as coming out. It just was. It was believed that the Creator made us, and it was also considered to be gifted because we could understand both the masculine and the feminine side of things. And a lot of times when kids were left orphaned, they were given to a two-spirit individual, because in Native American culture, they thought, what better to raise a child than someone that has both the feminine and masculine energy to be both the mother and the father. So, and then just learning more about my culture, just reading books on my own, and especially going to UWGB and majoring in First Nations Studies, I really learned a lot more about my own Oneida culture specifically. It means a lot to me now. I'm proud to be Mexican, Pueblo, Oneida, two-spirit, proud to be gay, proud to be everything that I am.
I've had a life-changing gift of your mentorship and advice.
for
as long as I can remember.
Well, I'm very proud of you. You've come a long, long way. So
we're all proud of you too.
That was Joseph Ray Torres of Oneida and Corey Carline of Green Bay. Their interview was recorded at StoryCorps, a national initiative to record and collect stories of everyday people. Excerpts were selected and produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of WPR and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
This is WPR.
I'm Gregory Berg, and after 2 days off for Thanksgiving, the morning show returns on Monday with a conversation with Lawrence Spinelli, talking about his fascinating new biography of Peter Rodino, U.S. Representative from New Jersey, who chaired the House Judiciary Committee that oversaw passage of three articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon stemming from the Watergate scandal. The book is called Unexpected Hero. Join us for Monday's morning show beginning just after 8.
It's morning edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. In sports, the Green Bay Packers got a win last night over the Miami Dolphins. They will be back in action next Thursday against Detroit. The Wisconsin Badgers football team will play against Minnesota at 11 this morning, final game of the regular season for the Badgers. And in weather, a winter weather advisory in effect for Vilas County until noon today. This is WPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Trains, planes, automobiles. Let's face it, holiday travel is stressful. The cost, the crowds, the weather delays. And then you add kids into the mix. If you've ever done it, then you know it can amp up the stress factor exponentially. So we thought we would try to help by answering your questions about traveling with kids. And for this, we've called two pediatricians who are also parents who have been through it themselves. Dr. Candace Jones is a pediatrician from Orlando, Florida. Welcome.
Thanks for having me this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. And Dr. Jamie Friedman is a pediatrician from San Diego, California. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much, and good morning.
Good morning. So I'm going to start with you, Dr. Freeman. Do you have any worries when you travel with your kids? And if so, what are they? Or maybe what's the biggest one?
Well, my kids are grown now, but when they were younger, definitely the biggest worry was, how am I going to occupy them, keep them busy, keep them interested, entertained, so we don't experience the meltdowns that I think everybody dreads when they travel with their children.
Dr. Jones, what about you? What is your biggest worry when you travel with your children?
We're right in the thick of everything you mentioned in your introduction. And my worries are always all the baggage, getting through security, standing in the lines. So I understand the pressure that parents are under, because I will be right with them.
So let's hear some questions from listeners. And this is from Erica Voch, and she's in Sacramento, California.
What's the real risk of kids contracting COVID on a flight? We haven't traveled since before the pandemic began and would love to, but we're concerned with the risk of COVID since our kids are still so young.
Dr. Freeman, thoughts?
Well, I think it's a really good question. The problem with air travel is when you're in the air, it's good. There's a lot of air turnover, which can really help keep particles out of the air. But it's those times when you're sitting there during boarding and then also deplaning when you arrive at the airport. I think the best thing to do is do your research on what are the rates where you are, where you're going, bring some hand sanitizer with you as well.
Dr. Jones, anything you want to add?
I totally agree with that. I think anywhere you can create some space for yourself in lines at the airport and take advantage of that family boarding so you have a little more space and you're not all crowded up, creating those barriers are very effective, and masking, absolutely.
All right, Dr. Jones, let's go to you first on this one. This one is from Amy Leo, who is in Tacoma Park, Maryland.
How can I ensure, in the midst of disrupted routines and new environments, that we all get the best sleep possible while traveling?
And you can hear that Amy is in the thick of it. You can hear that baby in the background. She knows what she's talking about. What do you say, Dr. Jones?
We all have been there as parents. I think this is where we try to manage our expectations when you're traveling, especially if it's international or a different time zone. and give yourself some grace and try to have a little patience for your kids, because they will get off. And as soon as possible, when you get to where you're going, just kind of reestablishing your bedtime or having those things that make them feel comfortable, their lovies, their passies, their favorite treats, anything that can recreate what they're used to is usually very helpful for getting them back on track.
But what I think I hear you saying is, don't fly across the country or to Europe or, you know, around the world for a wedding and then expect to go to that wedding the next day and have everybody be happy.
That's correct. Pre-planning is the key, and travel maybe a couple of days before so that you can get acclimated. I know we do that when we travel.
We also got a lot of questions about how to eat on the road with kids. Are there some snacks or meals or something that people could bring along for their kids to help them? And or is there anything parents should not pack? Dr. Jones, you have thoughts about this?
You know, I often recommend to parents, this is the time where to keep the peace, where maybe some of all of our pediatrician healthy rules can be, you know, put on pause. But things like if you want to try to go healthy, healthy non-perishable foods like packaged bars, nut butters and crackers, making a trail mix, even some fresh fruit or dried fruits are fine and they're easily packable. They'll get through security. But just their favorites is really key.
So I want to go to this next question because I think this is something that is important for people to hear, even if they have kids who have an issue or disability or they don't. And I'll just play that and then we'll talk about it.
My name is Kimberly Todd, and I'm from Sacramento, California. We travel often internationally as a family with our autistic daughter. Traveling with her as a young child was very stressful. Can you share information on how to obtain accommodations for a flight or what airport services may be available to traveling families that need additional support?
Dr. Friedman, do you want to start? What are your thoughts about this?
I think it does make sense to call ahead and say, hey, or at least call the airline and say, hey, can we get pre-boarding. So if you can get pre-boarding and be out of the crowd and on the plane and get settled, that can be helpful. I do think it's really important, you know, as the sort of the theme of this whole session is having sameness and familiarity. So whatever your child with special needs is used to, if there is, you know, something, you know, manipulatives in their hands that they like to have, things that they, if they're very oral, things that they can put in their mouth, if they're bothered by noise and they will wear, you know, noise canceling headphones, I know that can be very helpful, or have music. And you can make sort of like a lanyard with a tag or a tag on the shirt or a t-shirt or something that says, you know, I have autism or please be patient with me. I see that a lot. And I think that's really helpful because some people just don't understand. A lot of disabilities aren't obvious when you're looking at somebody.
Dr. Jones, any thoughts about this?
I would also talk to the flight crew so that they're aware of your child. I think they are often helpful and can work with families for whatever special things they need. And if they're aware, if there's a problem, they can step in and be ready to handle the situation. You know, I've said in the future, tap a person on the back and say, I'm sorry, I have this toddler. She may be kicking the seat, you know, or something like that. So talk to people around you and let them know. And I think people will come together and help make it as easy as possible.
That is Dr. Candace Jones from Orlando, Florida, and Dr. Jamie Friedman from San Diego, California. They are both board-certified pediatricians offering their advice for how to travel with kids. Thank you both so much for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Rob Schmitz. That'll do it for Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you so much for spending part of your Friday with us, the final Friday in the month of November. Of course, as always, thanks to John Davis, who helps bring us the news each and every weekday here as well. That news is on the way on WPR.
Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin DNR. Preventing food waste and composting scraps and uneaten veggies, grains, and fruit can help the environment. More dnr.wi.gov by searching food waste.
A Southeast Wisconsin tradition continues when the UW Parkside Master Singers and Voices of Parkside sing Handel's Complete Messiah Saturday evening, December 7th, and Sunday afternoon, December 8th, in Bedford Hall. For tickets and more information, visit uwp.edu/the Rita. This is WGTD HD.